Hello and welcome to the Cycling Podcast. My name is Richard Moore. I'm with Lionel Burney.
Hello, Richard.
And Daniel Freeb.
Hello, Richard.
Grinning like a Cheshire cat. So we've got lots to talk about in today's show. We're going to wrap up the classics, spring classics, finished on Sunday with Liège-Bastogne-Liège. We're now into stage race season. We're going to talk a little bit about Liège-Bastogne-Liège and wrap up the classics. Then we're going to talk a little bit about this week's big story concerning the painkiller tramadol. Part three, we're going to talk a little bit about Team Sky and their problems so far this season. We also have a Team Sky scoop, a major news story, breaking news right here on the podcast. So stay tuned to part three. Daniel's leaning in as if he's going to say something funny.
Why didn't you ask me to tell the audience where we are?
Oh yeah, we could do that. Okay, why not? We've not done that for a while. So where are we, Daniel?
We're somewhere in London. Lionel Richie recorded that in 2006. only 45 more Lionel Richie singles to go, and I'm sure he's making new material as we speak.
That's the closest you come to preparation for this podcast.
The Cycling Podcast, interviews and analysis. We've got the big talking points covered.
Liège-Bastogne-Liège, not the most exciting race. I mean, the classic season was almost a season of two halves, wasn't it? The first few, Milan-San Remo, Tour of Flanders, Paris-Roubaix, were all very thrilling races. Lots to talk about, great storylines from those races. Then the Ardennes Classics plus Amstel Gold, not so much. And traditionally, those have been perhaps more exciting races, or certainly over recent years. I can think of many editions of Liège-Bastogne-Liège which have been thoroughly entertaining, but this year's was a bit of a damn squib, wasn't it?
It certainly was, yeah. I mean, I didn't get to watch it live on the Sunday, the first one I've not watched live of the Spring Classics this year, but I watched about the last 55k that I'd recorded, watched it the following day, and after about 15 or 20 kilometres of just watching nothing happening, I used the old Skybox to watch it on fast forward, which improved it a bit, but not much. And then I slowed down and watched the last sort of 10k in real time, and even that was a bit much because it was
like watching it in 1994 or something, was it? 1998.
Who won?
In 99 was it Frank Vandenbroek? 99. Yep. That was fast forward.
Yeah, that
it?
Was when he big ringed it on La Redoute, wasn't it? And the steep climbs towards finish. Yeah,
he named the day before the race. I think he said the number of the house that he was going to attack in front of on the Côte de Saint-Nicolas, and sure enough he did.
Yeah, it wasn't the greatest race, was it? They waited until the last climb. They waited until the last corner, really, Valverde and Simon Gerrans. I mean, can't really criticise Gerrans because that was how he was going to win the race. It was a terrific tactical unpicking of all of the rest. And Daniel Martin's slip on the last corner did give some artificial drama to it, really. It wasn't a race that was packed full of drama, but it had that moment that we'll remember as one of the moments of the season, I suppose, because the debate will start, and I'm sure we'll have a heated debate about whether Dan Martin would have won or not. I won't prejudice that, although you're going to debate that a bit later on. But I think these three races, Amstel, Flèche Wallonne and Liège-Bastogne-Liège, are struggling a bit at the moment because it's not the first year where we've had quite formulaic racing. In the past, we've had the situation where the same rider has won all three. That's become quite a familiar theme. You can more or less boil all three races down now to very, very short, intense moments. So Amstel Gold used to be all about the sprint up the Coburg. It's now about the sprint over the Coburg and the descent to the finish. It's made it slightly more interesting than it was, but really Gilbert won that with a carbon copy of the way he won the World Championships. It's something we have seen before. Flèche Wallonne is now just, and has been for ages, and I think we said once you've seen one sprint on the Mur de Huy, you've kind of seen them all. It's interesting, but there's nothing else about the race that really grabs you. And Liège-Bastogne-Liège has kind of gone the same way. And Joe Lindsay on the bicycling website made a very good point that the riders have kind of learned the courses now, and perhaps Liège-Bastogne-Liège in particular needs a bit of a shake-up. you know, alter some of the running back to Liège, maybe get rid of that uphill finish and run it back into the centre of Liège like it was in the old days. Daniel?
They still do obviously rejig the finale of Liège, and even this year it changed slightly from last year. But yeah, I know what you're saying, Lionel. You know, why was it so sterile, the race? And there were some interesting opinions voiced after the race. Patrick Lefevre, the manager of Omega Pharma Quickstep, he talks about how the courses now are so hard in these races, particularly a race like Liège. It really is so brutal that everyone's only really got one cartridge that they're willing to fire. And you know, they know that once they have attacked, that's pretty much them done. And, you know, when you factor in as well the importance of ranking points now and the direct correlation of ranking points with contracts and what the rider's going to earn next year, you know, we look at the top 25 at Liège on Sunday and we maybe think, you know, so-and-so, I don't know, Koenigo, for example, I don't know where he finished, but say he finished in 16th place, we might think, oh, he'll be disappointed because he hasn't won. Well, he might actually go home on Sunday night and think, I had a really good day at the office today because, you know, I've got so many so many ranking points, and that means, you know, an extra 50 grand on my contract next year. So a lot of those guys know they can't win, and it's a choice between, you know, a really, really long shot of a long range attack or just knowing that they can get some points, you know. And I mean, there were other people, Romain Bardet, for example, AG2R, he just said that, you know, riders don't show enough courage these days.
Dan Martin, sorry, Richard, I was going to ask you. Dan Martin said that you have to be prepared to lose a race in order to win it, and he certainly showed that both in Flèche Wallonne and in Liège-Bastogne-Liège this year, as he did in Liège-Bastogne-Liège last year. But he really was the only one, wasn't he?
Yeah, I mean, watching that final claim, you're right. Simon Gerrans, played it.
Jeremiah?
Well, I see Gero, but Simon Gerrans. Not that I call him Gero. Oh, okay. I don't call riders by their nicknames. Very against that. But yeah, Simon Gerrans, if you watch the final climb, he played it perfectly. He positioned himself on Valverde's wheel. Valverde was certainly the guy to watch. He just glued himself to his wheel all the way up, you know, and played the patient game. And yeah, he didn't risk all like Dan Martin did, but he calculated perfectly, brilliantly. Now, that there's a lot to admire about that. You don't often reflect on a Simon Gerrans victory and go, wow, he really deserved to win that race. You know, Milan San Remo a couple of years ago that he won, it was again a calculating performance. He was with Nibali and Cancellara, wasn't he? And it was a calculating win that, again, you admire, but you don't, it doesn't make your heart race, does it? So you don't look back on Liège-Bastogne-Liège and go, that race really had a worthy winner. Not say that he did.
Tan Man's not here. Oh, right. Old friend of the podcast, Anthony.
I maybe phrased that a little clumsily, but what I mean is he wasn't the standout performer on the day. Dan Martin probably was for that late attack on the coming up to the finish. And
a nod also to Giampaolo Caruso and Domenico Pozzovivo, because they did at least make a move on the San Nicolas, but that was never going to work because of the pace from the group behind. And of course Orica, Green Edge, Quickstep as well, Omega Pharma Quickstep, were setting such a fierce pace between the climbs that basically it didn't look like anybody really had any room to move on the climbs. It was almost like they were recovering on the climbs.
It's funny, Liège-Bastogne-Liège was always traditionally a race that really suited general classification riders, guys who could win the Grand Tours, going right back here. But and even recently, you know, Andy Schleck used to always ride well at Liège-Bastogne-Liège, and with the exception of Valverde, there weren't many Grand Tour contenders really up there in that race. Chris Froome, of course, didn't start because he fell ill overnight. But yeah, that's a shame as well, because it is the one day race that should bring the best classics riders up against the best Grand Tour riders, and with the exception, as I say, of Valverde, there weren't many up there.
Is this a problem for these races going forward? Because at a time when cycling is trying to make itself more appealing to a television audience, I can see the appeal for a more casual fan to sit down and watch 2-3 hours of the Tour of Flanders or Paris-Roubaix, but I'd really struggle to sell any of those races other than the last, you know, the last climb of all three of them. I'd struggle to sell that to a kind of casual sports fan as saying, look, this is cycling at its peak.
Yeah, I think we shouldn't perhaps generalise that. We haven't seen many Liège-Bastogne-Liège like Sunday. There haven't been many times where there have been that many riders. I don't know how many there were coming up that final climb in Anse. It was maybe 30, 40. That is certainly an exception. And you know, people, first-time view, if we are talking about new audience and first-time viewers, you know, they're always blown away by the Moeder Hooy and Flèche Wallonne. It tends to be, you know, perhaps when, like you say, Lionel, when you've seen 4, 5, 6, then you start to get a little bored of it. But no, so I don't necessarily think there's a major problem. But this, you know, we've seen for years now this tendency to make races tougher and tougher and tougher, not always with very satisfactory results in terms of the spectacle. And I think it's just a fine balance for the organisers to strike always. And I think the Tour de France does pretty well. I think the Giro is obviously, you know, we've talked before, has lurched too far towards the extreme at times, and they've brought it back a bit this year, and it is difficult. And you know, there are other imponderables like the weather and you know, how the teams decide to ride.
Can we do the heated debate now, please?
Order! Order! Order!
The heated debate.
The heated debate this week is all about Dan Martin and Liège-Bastogne-Liège. Would he have won had he not slipped on the final corner or not? Arguing the case that he would have won is Richard Moore. And we've decided, in the interest of economy, to give only 30 seconds. So you've got to get your point across. I know you'll probably try and use a minute and a half, but try and keep it to 30 seconds. So, Richard, would Daniel Martin have won Liège-Bastogne-Liège?
I don't need 30 seconds. Yes, I think he would have won Liège-Bastogne-Liège. I think he rode the perfect race. We had hardly seen him all day. He's won the race before, of course. He won it last year. And last year, if you look at the efforts he made to bridge up to Rodriguez to counter-attack, he made several efforts. I think he went, he attacked at just the right time. There was a lull. He got the gap. He bridged up to Caruso. Caruso had been out for a long time. He was tiring. Martin was fresh. He still had something left. He would have won.
Wow. Efficient. 27 seconds. Daniel, would Daniel Martin have won Liège-Bastogne-Liège but for that slip? Your time starts now.
No, he definitely wouldn't have won it. He was on Caruso's wheel, and within 2 or 3 seconds of them coming around that last bend, Gerrans' group was already on top of them. Martin had attacked about 700 metres out, 800 metres out. He'd already expended an awful lot of energy. I can't imagine that he had any more juice left. But it was reminiscent of the finale of the 1970 Liège-Bastogne-Liège, where the De Vlaeminck brothers, that's Roger and Eric, they did a bit of a pincer movement on Eddie Merckx, and Roger Le Gitan, friend of the podcast, he was triumphant on that occasion.
Well, we allowed you to go 3 seconds over there because we couldn't deny the audience the Roger De Vlaeminck anecdote. Probably there's a lot of people in the audience just flabbergasted to learn of the existence of a brother. There was, in fact, yeah, Roger De Vlaeminck had a brother, Eric.
We started on him. Eric is an even more colourful character than Roger.
I have to agree with you, Daniel. To me, I don't think Dan Martin would have won. I think he fell because, I mean, studying the final, studying that crash, and there were some rumours about when he hit a pen or a banana skin or oil or something. I mean, he might have hit oil, but I think it's possible that he actually clipped his pedal on the road, and that, I think, if that's the case, then that's a sign of just how exhausted he was. That's the kind of thing that you do when your arms are filling up with lactic acid and you're barely able to see straight. And so that suggests to me that perhaps he wouldn't have won. So I'm talking myself out of victory there.
So to agree that Daniel won the heated debate, or to go against Richard's own instinct, just get in touch on Twitter. We're at @cycling_podcast and use the hashtag heated debate.
This is the Cycling Podcast with Richard Moore, Lionel Burney and Daniel Freeb.
So that's enough of the frivolous stuff. Tramadol, painkiller. It's been in the news this week. There's a mention of Tramadol in Michael Barry's new book, which has been published this week. And he mentions that Tramadol was something that he used at Team Sky. He sort of voices his concern that a lot of riders are using this pretty powerful painkiller. We should point out that it is legal. It's not on the banned list, although we know that the UCI are monitoring it. From sort of making some inquiries this week, they're quite late to be monitoring it, I think, because it's certainly been around in the peloton for a number of years, certainly since 2009. have some pretty reliable evidence that it was being used by some riders in 2009. So it's been, you know, there's been a lot of, again, the focus on Team Sky, because Michael Barry admits that he used it while riding at Team Sky, which of course is a drug-free team. Yeah. Well, which team isn't drug-free? But it's a tricky one. We're in a grey area here, aren't we, of a product that is, you know, some say has got very strong side effects. I've never actually taken it myself. I do have some at home. I might do it. I might take some for a podcast as an experiment. See if anyone can tell the difference. But Daniel, I mean, you've got some strong views on the whole tramadol story.
You know, you say it's a grey area, Richard, but it really shouldn't be, in the sense that it is legal. It probably shouldn't be legal because it fulfills two of the criteria by which WADA usually deem a substance to be banned. So it's potentially damaging to your health if taken in excess, and it potentially enhances performance. But I think that is what they need to establish. Does it indeed do those two things? I spoke to one of the foremost anti-doping experts in Europe today, actually, about tramadol, Michel Audran from the University of Montpellier, and he really was very dubious about its performance enhancing properties. He said that it might allow you to ride when otherwise you wouldn't be in a fit state to ride, if you were, you know, suffering from an injury or in too much pain. But in terms of actually boosting someone's ability, he was very, very dubious. But I think the problem arises when you get people drawing different lines in different places. There are some people, you know, Christophe Basson is one that springs to mind. He really didn't pay. Christophe Basson, of course, Mr. Clean, famous for his anti-doping stance in the 1999 Tour. He didn't take his line as the same line as the one dictated by the governing bodies. For him, anything that wasn't natural was out of bounds. But the majority of riders and the majority of teams would say that, you know, we have to take our lead from the UCI, we have to take our lead from their rules, and anything that's not on the ban list goes, really.
We can't assume that everybody in professional sport is like Christophe Basson. In fact, we should probably assume the opposite. We did have this discussion in our live podcast as well about this grey area of products that are legal but perhaps not in keeping with the spirit of sport, if not yet the laws of sport. A bit of a tangent here, but I was at a Michael Lewis talk last night. Michael Lewis is the author of several books, including a couple of sports books, but he writes primarily about the financial markets. His latest book, Flash Boys, is about boys largely on the stock market who are coming up with ever more imaginative wheezes and finding new loopholes to make more money for themselves and their clients. And it was interesting looking around the audience and seeing many sort of flash boys in the audience nodding in admiration at some of the stories of quite disgraceful behaviour, really. And I got this impression of this. It reminded me of elite sport, where for a lot of them, this is the game. This is part of the game. And, you know, if looking back to Lance Armstrong, and it'd be an interesting line of inquiry with him, but, you know, what gave him most satisfaction, winning the tour or winning the game of cheating? And we have to assume that an awful lot of people in the world of elite sport are of this mind, that for them it is a game, and if you close one loophole, they'll find another one. And I think tramadol is something that has been very popular since around about 2008-2009, when doping was reduced for various reasons, including the biological passport. You can talk about a change in culture, and there has been a change in culture, but there will still be loopholes. And it's probably been something that's been quite easy to justify to yourself as a rider. I'm not cheating. I'm using something that's legal. It's a painkiller. But, you know, things, attitudes change very quickly now, don't they? Now, this week we're talking about tramadol. Taking tramadol this week is different to almost to taking it last week. Last week nobody was really talking about it an awful lot.
I think it was Taylor Finney, wasn't it, who kind of flagged this up maybe 18 months ago when he said something on Twitter in praise of his BMC racing teammate Steve Cummings, the British rider, saying that Cummings, like Taylor Finney, doesn't use painkillers or even caffeine, and the comment was something like purest of the pure. And I think that, as you say, Richard, you know, the grey area is that tramadol is currently not banned. If you take another substance which is a stimulant, caffeine, which was banned throughout the 90s and then was taken off the WADA list in 2004, you know, you're exactly right. The attitudes to that, you know, in 1995, being over the limit for caffeine in cycling would have led to a ban. In 2005, you could take as much caffeine as you like.
Gianni Bugno tested positive for caffeine, didn't he?
I think he did, yeah. We might need to check that. But certainly, you know, caffeine now is marketed to cyclists, amateur cyclists, in the form of gels, you know, up 25, 50, 100 millilitres, milligrams of caffeine in a gel in some cases. You know, these are quite high doses of a substance which, you know, you can make arguments for and against the, you know, whether that's... I mean, I've used them in sportives or in sort of third cat races.
Lionel,
caffeine gels. Well, they
explains a lot, doesn't it?
They help. I'm on one now. I'm absolutely wired.
Doesn't actually explain a lot.
No, it doesn't.
But yeah. I was just going to say, just thinking back to, I don't know whether, should I say the team and the rider? Probably. Does it matter? Does it matter? I don't know.
No, 2009
Gent Wevelgem.
If it happened, then see it.
Yeah, 2009 Gent Wevelgem in the HTC team car. George Hincapie asked for his finish bottle from the team car. He was given a bottle, he took a swig, he threw it away, it wasn't the one he wanted. He asked again, I want my finished bottle, and then he drank that one. And I asked in the car, you know, what's in that bottle, and I was told basically a lot of caffeine. So that's something where the sort of the boundary is caffeine's allowed, but is it sensible in those high quantities? You know, tramadol, it's a different substance, it's a different question, but at the moment it's not on the banned list, and until it is, there's an awful lot of talk about whether it should be allowed, but until it's put onto the WADA list, it's a story that's kind of creating a lot of hot air, and it's drawing links back to doping for completely obvious reasons. But we're not really kind of, you know, where are we getting to with the debate at the moment? I mean, I'm not getting anywhere,
it's
am I?
Not, but at the same time, I don't think it's a bad debate to be having. I think this debate about what is and isn't doping is an ongoing debate. I don't think we're ever going to settle it. That line is always going to move. The WADA code is always going to be revised and changed. So we're never going to really reach a point where we can say for definite, this is doping, this isn't doping, and that's how it will always be. It's always going to shift around. I mean, I spoke to a team doctor this week as well, who was pretty clear that tramadol is not something that you shouldn't be racing if you have injuries or a condition that necessitates tramadol. That's his view, and that's the policy on that team. It's also the policy of the Movement for Credible Cycling this year that tramadol is not allowed. You know, whether teams adhere to that is hard to say, because the Movement for Credible Cycling is not a body that has any sort of real actual powers. It's an agreement,
and it's voluntary as well.
It's a voluntary organisation.
Just another point we should maybe make about the use of tramadol. We're talking here about it being used to basically sort of deaden the pain of riding, presumably in the closing stages of races. And when you talk about whether that's a performance enhancer, it always reminds me, and sorry to mention football again, but years ago, I know you're wincing at the mention of football, but years ago it was common to read the pre-match kind of team news and hear that a player had, you know, had a pain-killing injection in order to enable them to play. And my definition of performance enhancing is that is almost the ultimate performance enhancer. Well, going from not being able to run and shoot to being able to run and shoot.
The argument of performance enhancing or performance enabling, but they are pretty much two sides of the same coin, aren't they?
Anything to add on tramadol, Daniel?
No,
is
just
that your eyes have glazed over as though you're...
Yeah. Just really that I think it's slightly disingenuous of Michael Barry to say in his book that tramadol is more potent or effective than any banned drug that he'd ever taken, which obviously included EPO. That seems to me almost a way of kind of exonerating himself and suggesting that what is going on, what might still be going on in the pro peloton, is, you know, as bad and as poisonous as, you know, the culture that reigned when he was a rider. And I don't think that's the case. I think generally it's a positive development if we're now talking about, well, it's certainly a lesser evil if we're now talking about caffeine, ibuprofen, tramadol, when years ago we were talking about EPO, blood transfusions.
Again, it muddies the waters a little bit in that, you know, Michael Barry in his book, like a lot of other former dopers, you know, mentioned this epiphany they had in 2006 when they went from doping to not doping, and clearly that was a decision he'd made, and yet after that, by his own volition, he obviously used tramadol. So he was clearly able to reconcile that at the time, and I think this just illustrates how attitudes do change. You know, riders will always, I think it's quite common to use ibuprofen, paracetamol, aspirin, whatever. Who's to say we're not going to be talking about those next year? As, yeah, it changes all the time. I mean, we replayed, I tweeted the other day, an interview that we did during the podcast last year with Alan Farrell, the Team Sky doctor, who at the time the topics that we were talking about were TUEs and supplements and things like this. And I spoke to him, you know, asked him about that. If we were doing the interview today, we'd be asking him about tramadol. Tramadol wasn't really on the radar last year. At the tour this year, it'll be something else. Carbohydrates, glucose. I'm joking, but you know, the topic du jour is changing all the time. And we are. I mean, I think there's a value to the debate because we are sort of zeroing in on what we think or what people think is doping and isn't doping. And I think there is a consensus being arrived at, and you know, WADA are clearly the important body in determining.
They can end this debate on this particular substance, and they should
very quickly.
Well, yeah, they're supposedly monitoring, but I'm sure there's actually not much monitoring they need to do in order to establish that it is being used, because it's very, very easily detectable. And what they are probably deliberating is the implications of banning it. Is it so prevalent in certain sports which adhere to the WADA code that it will create problems and it will lead to opposition?
Just lastly, that point you made there, Richard, about anyone who needs tramadol shouldn't be competing in elite sport. I think that's a very important point to make, because in an ideal world, of course not. But we see frequently, you know, riders will push themselves to ridiculous and often unhealthy points because, you know, they're either thinking about their contract or they're just ambitious, driven to try and help themselves or help their team or get their next contract or earn the place in the Tour de France team or whatever it happens to be. And I think back to the Dauphiné I spent with Team Sky a few years ago, and I've probably mentioned this before, but you know, Rigoberto Urán was having quite serious chest problems during that race, and Team Sky's doctor basically asked a race doctor for permission to apply for a TUE for a substance. I can't remember off the top of my head what it was. It may have been salbutamol or something from that kind of family. And, you know, it took a couple of days to get that TUE paperwork all, you know, in place. And the Sky doctor was having to make calls out of hours to the UCI to get permission, liaising with the race doctor, to enable Rigoberto Urán to complete the race and, you know, basically do his job. And I said to the doctor, you know, is there an argument to be had to say that actually the best thing for Rigoberto Urán in that case is to go home and rest and not exacerbate the problem further? And he said, well, absolutely there is, but, you know, you've got to do, as a doctor, you've got to look after the health of the rider, knowing that they're going to push themselves anyway. If the TUE hadn't been forthcoming, would Rigoberto Urán have pulled out of the race? Probably not. He probably would have carried on and done himself more damage.
You're listening to the Cycling Podcast. Tweet us at cycling_podcast.
Sky woes, Sky fail.
Do you want to just repeat what you just said to us, Rich, off air about going for a beer after this?
Oh, I can't wait for a beer. It's been a while.
Go on.
Been drinking a lot of wine recently.
Yeah.
Anyway, let's talk about Team Sky. They've had a dreadful spring campaign.
Dreadful? Is that the right adjective? It's pretty
yeah,
poor, isn't it?
Yeah. Yeah, I think dreadful. I think we can officially declare it as dreadful. It was. I mean, especially in the Ardennes. I understand that Dave Brailsford was a very, very unhappy man the day after Flesh Wallone, for example.
They were abject in that race. I mean, I think I saw one rider come over the second time over the Moor, and that was David Lopez.
They're having a lot of problems. I think you speak to people at Team Sky and they say that it's just bad luck, you know, a lot of injuries, illnesses. There is a bigger question about whether they prioritise the Tour de France to the detriment of everything else, and there will be riders who are perhaps Sunday's a case in point. Chris Froome is a special case because he's the defending Tour de France winner, and that's his main goal for the year. But he pulled out of Liège-Bastogne-Liège almost as a precautionary measure, and you wonder if that is replicated throughout the team, that riders will not, if they feel below par or they're nursing an injury. This kind of contradicts the last segment a little bit, but will they pull out races perhaps when they don't have to, because they're looking at making the team for the Tour? I don't know. Who knows?
Well, in Froome's case, I think the Tour of Romandy is a much more important building block towards the Tour. Yes. He can still get to the Tour in good shape if he has a good Romandy and a good Dauphiné. So, racing Liège-Bastogne-Liège, even a little bit off colour, it certainly wasn't going to add anything for him. It could only undo or jeopardise the value of his week in Romandy, probably.
Do I want my scoop now? I'll just drop in
the scoop.
In a unprofessional manner. Can we build this up, a drum roll or something?
Scoop, 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 scoop.
Brilliant.
Let's hope it doesn't sort of leak out on Twitter before we've actually managed to get the podcast.
It's going to be underwhelming now. No, I understand that an agreement has been reached for him to join BMC. So Edvald Boasenhagen, who's been at Team Sky since 2010, since the inception of that team, you could say that...
This does contravene UCI rules about negotiating with riders before.
Well, it's, you know...
No, it does.
Oh, yeah, okay. I see what you're getting at earlier. Yeah, of course. But he was almost the biggest fish signed by Team Sky in 2010, but...
Well,
yeah,
long contract, wasn't it?
A very long... He's 4 years, I think, initially. But he's a very popular member of the team, even if he hasn't quite delivered on his... potential, but he's not the rider that people thought he would become, and so he's joining BMC. But no, I understand that an agreement has been reached for him to join BMC.
It wouldn't be the first time BMC have broken that rule about negotiating before a certain date in the year, would it? I mean, they were
who kids themselves at that people observe that rule? Hang on a second, you know.
We don't obviously, but I mean. It is a rule. I mean, it's a rule for a reason, isn't it? It's to try and stop big, wealthy teams basically bombing smaller teams out of the water by poaching all their best riders.
Poor Sky.
It's a danger. Yeah. Boasenhagen is in a slightly dangerous position now. Well, I think the die is probably already cast as far as his Tour de France selection is concerned, because he's riding the Giro, so he won't ride the Tour. But we've seen often in the past, when news has leaked of riders changing teams at the end of the season, their race programme has often suffered as a result of that.
They get sent to the Tour of Beijing, allegedly.
Tour of Britain.
I was only joking. Mick Richard said that.
On the wider point, on Boasenhagen.
On paper, is BMC ever a good fit for anyone? but for him, I think it might be, and certainly things are looking up there. But of course, he had his best results at HTC, and he was running under Valeria Piva and Alan Piper, and they are the management duo who have brought about a turnaround in BMC's fortune, certainly this spring, and things look to be moving in the right direction there.
What do we think of Sky, though? I mean, they could still win the Tour again, but if they don't, they will have had a pretty dismal season. Given that all the eggs are in the Tour basket, that there's an awful lot riding on that now. And Chris Froome, for all that he won the Tour of Oman, and says he's in good shape, his form is a little bit of an unknown quantity at the moment, I think.
Yeah, and I mean, we could be sitting here in a few weeks' time after the Tour of California with Bradley Wiggins. You know, he may pull a result out of there. Froome may come good. He's off to a decent start in Romandy. There's stages that will suit him a bit later in the week. The Giro, they kind of can't really lose, because they are not going to go in there with even a B-lister for the GC. You know, Cataldo might get up there in the top 10, But really, I think the more alarming thing is the previous 2 years, even if only in hindsight, perhaps in 2012, you could see the tour group kind of coming together. In 2011, they had that catastrophic idea of having, you know, splitting the tour team down the middle and having half do one kind of program and the other half do the other program, right up to the Dauphiné and Swiss races in June, and then they'd pick the best of both to come together for the tour, and it just didn't work. It didn't gel. Sorry, that's 2010. 2011, they completely changed it, and they got that group around Wiggins, and they went through the stage races up to the Dauphiné, which Wiggins won. Obviously, Wiggins then fell off in the tour, and we didn't get to see how it would pan out. They did the same pattern in 2012, and obviously it worked perfectly. And then, more or less, Froome... OK, the races were slightly different, but Froome followed that same sort of hopscotch to the tour by going to stage races and racing to win. This year, there's no real pattern to what they're doing. Froome has kind of been... he hasn't been as good. He's pulled out of races. Port has pulled out of races. We haven't seen anything of Port yet. Geraint Thomas has done very well in Paris-Nice, but for a crash. But it's very hard. I think you could probably write down what Sky's nine-man tour team would be and get quite close, even now, at the start of May. But the big question is, what kind of form are they going to be in? Are they all going to be lined up to work for Froome? Are they going to be good enough? Daniel?
I think the balance of the roster is wrong. It's slightly wrong, in the sense that I think there are too many riders on that roster, in that squad, who are too far back, too early in their growth curve. If you look at the young riders in that team, the Josh Edmondsons, the Boswells, the Dombrovskis, even to a certain extent Kenyuk, although Kenyuk has really started to emerge of late, I think they're developing fairly slowly when you compare them to other teams. You know, we've seen near pros very competitive in other teams. We've seen second year pros very, very competitive in other teams. And those guys, and even, you know, Salvatore Puccio, they're very happy with the job he does at the team, but he's certainly not someone who will fill a hole when you're struggling for wins. And I think there are a lot of riders who are very, very early on their growth curve, and I think they've got a lot of domestiques who are very well suited to supporting a leader in Grand Tours, but what they're lacking is those kind of stopgap guys. You know, maybe this is the role that Cataldo's, the Boissenhagen's should be fulfilling. That, you know, they need to pop up with a few wins at the Volta Catalunya or you know, Circuit de la Sarthe, something like that. But just to avoid that sensation of the team really being in a bad position. Yeah, in a trough.
I mean, honourable mention to Ben Swift, who has had a remarkable season, really, having, you know, this was a make or break season for him, and he has been vulnerable in the past to injury, and but when his health is good and he's had a good winter, he's a phenomenal rider, and he's gone close in the Giro before to stage wins, and who's to say that he won't pop up with a stage win there? And yeah, a stage win on Irish roads would be a particularly satisfying outcome for him, I would think.
I mean, would you agree with what I said there, Rich, about the roster, about the balance of the roster, and it's slightly too heavily weighted towards guys at the start of their career, or perhaps just near pros or young riders who have not hit the ground running in their pro careers as one might have expected?
Yeah, I would agree with that, and there are some signings to the team that I don't really understand. I never really understood Rigoberto Urán at Team Sky. Don't understand Sergio Henao at Team Sky. He's obviously out of action at the moment as they investigate his mysterious blood values. But I didn't really understand what signing them...
They were cheap.
...brought to the team.
They were cheap. I mean, it was a classic kind of Moneyball signings they were, in the sense that they represented very good value for money.
I didn't want to sound anti-clubbing there, and I'm not at all. But I just want, you know, in terms of building a team that is a cohesive unit. I remember when Dave Brailsford was setting Team Sky up, he talked about having a lot of, you know, Australians, British, Scandinavian guys. It's not anything against anyone from other countries, and this is not a UKIP party broadcast here. It's just about basic communication, you know, and about being on the same kind of wavelength. And I think that they've kind of diluted that a little bit, and I'm not sure that the team is as cohesive a unit as it might have been.
I think the other thing about Sky is they don't the way they race is you know, it's quite formulaic. They've got a lot of people who are very good stage racers, and stage racing is all about caution and about preserving and protecting and kind of turning the screw when you have to, not necessarily when you can, but when you can make the biggest gains in the shortest amount of time. You don't really see many sky riders in one day races or they don't really go stage hunting particularly well. They don't really have those kind of riders. I mean, we've seen Lopez do some moves in some of the Spanish stage races.
I don't think that element of it excites Dave Brailsford and the management as much as planning really methodically over several months for a big push on a major tour. I think that is what they're used to. That was their bread and butter when they were on the Olympic program.
The other rider they miss is Michael Rogers, you know, that senior road captain type. And I know that Geraint Thomas fulfills the road captain role sometimes, but I think Michael Rogers had a certain commanded a certain respect in the peloton, and he certainly knew what he was doing. And I think they haven't really replaced him.
But if you've got a ride like Bosenhagen, who, he's very good at lots of different things, but he never seems to get that license to go out and try and win a race. And I know what you're saying there, Daniel, but there's nothing that kind of improves morale in a team than just picking up a few wins.
I mean, 2011, when Bosenhagen really had the bit between his teeth and he won two stages of the tour, and we saw him ride and. You know, if he rode as aggressively as that, with that kind of determination, you think that he would win more races.
I mean, I think the point we should make, though, is that Sky are far from the only team having a difficult start to the season. And there are always teams that get to April, May, and who have barely won a race. I mean, Astana are really struggling this year. Lampre are really struggling. AG2R are usually dreadful up until this time of year. They're actually doing extremely well this year. So, you can easily start exaggerating and thinking that you're in a real crisis. I think when things are not going well and, you've got injuries, illnesses, and you've just got to stay calm and, I think, stay focused on the job, and that's what Sky have to do.
I think that's the beauty of bike racing, though, isn't it? There can only be one winner, and there's 20-odd teams that are all trying to get those wins, and winning does seem to... it's just almost self-fulfilling. Teams get on rolls and we'll see maybe some other teams come to the fore in the Giro. I can't necessarily see Sky being one of them, but perhaps the time for the post-mortem will be after the tour rather than now.
Yeah, I think so. We're going to look like idiots, aren't we, when the Giro...
We look like idiots anyway, yeah, most of the time.
That's true. When Ben Swift wins the Giro. So that's all for this week. We'll be back next week. We'll be talking about the Women's Tour of Britain next week, which also starts... the same sort of week as the Giro in Belfast, so we'll be looking ahead to all those. You chaps are off to the Giro, so you'll we'll
your birthday, isn't it, Rich?
It's my birthday.
We're missing your birthday
well.
Party.
We'll
festivities.
We'll do a podcast maybe on my birthday, a special birthday podcast, and you can sing Happy Birthday and
share it with anyone interesting. Well, when is
my
it?
My birthday, May the 7th.
May the 7th.
Yeah, I do, but I can't remember who now.
It's bound to be some sort of 1990s.
Richard wasn't born in the 1990s, Daniel. I don't know where you get that idea from.
I can't remember now who I share it with, but I do share it with some people. My aunt, but also other people. Lionel, thank you very much.
Thank you, Richard.
Thank you, Daniel.
Thanks, Rich.
The Cycling Podcast. Subscribe on iTunes, listen on Audioboo, and visit us at thecyclingpodcast.com.